to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 609. I'm Jim McDowell, going solo, riding one up as it were, for this episode to bring you all the great action from the MotoGP races at Assen. The Dutch TT is the cathedral of speed, and the racing did not disappoint us at all this weekend. But let's get into the more important things, such as a little listener feedback. So we got some feedback from Doug Moore. Doug, thanks for writing in. Basically, Doug was saying how much he liked the long edition of the podcast with the nitty-gritty detail of qualifying for each and every class. And we did skip over some stuff in the last episode. I apologize for that, Doug. As an engineer, I'm glad you see it my way. I am a detail-oriented person. So hopefully we can find a balance for everybody to where it's not too newsy, but it's more opinionated, and it's still at a time frame that most people will enjoy. But I would personally want to thank you, Doug, for reaching out to us and sending us in feedback. I appreciate that. We love to know what's going on. And if you would like to be able to communicate with us, you can. You can just simply send in your listener feedback to motopod at motopodcast.com. Everything you do, far as writing in, we like to hear. The good, the bad, the ugly helps us make the show better. So with that, let us get on to the news. So in the first part, Jorge Lorenzo had a massive crash in free practice at Assen. It was a very scary crash, very high speed. Lorenzo basically took off and did a low side, which shouldn't have been that dramatic, except for the fact that he tumbled into the gravel trap. And when he did, it appeared as though his neck kind of went into an area where maybe the bike had plowed up some of the gravel, and it looked like he had kind of just bent his neck. And it was a very scary moment for me personally. I remember back in 93 in Misano when Wayne Rainey was paralyzed, and I just remember that horrifying image of him tumbling that way with, you could just see his head and neck area just being kind of scrunched in the gravel trap. So it was a great relief to me to see Jorge stand up, and he was walked away, which is the best thing we do, although he was taken to the Clinica Mobile. They did some x-rays and stuff. They thought that he potentially had a broken vertebrae or a fractured vertebrae. That turned out to be true. He does have that. That has forced him to miss the race in Assen and will also force him to miss the race in the Sachsenring. Wish a speedy recovery to Jorge from over here at Motopod, but that is nothing to mess with if you've got a fracture in one of the vertebrae in your neck. So Jorge is lucky to get away from that. You know, there is that possibility that maybe that fracture happened at the horrifying crash he had at testing at Barcelona, but we may never know exactly when or why it happened. We just know that he does have one, because sometimes fractures like that take more than a few days to actually appear in an x-ray. So again, glad to see Jorge Lorenzo is all right, and he'll be back racing with us as soon as he's done convalescing. And that's another bit of news. Rumor had it that at the Barcelona test that the KTM Moto2 team was testing a completely new chassis for Binder and Martin. KTM denied this, which means it must be true. And if you look at the results that happened this weekend, maybe they really did have a new chassis. So good to see KTM apparently making some progress. And finally, a very sad piece of news. American motorcycle racer Carlin Dunn has tragically lost his life at the Pikes Peak Hill Climb. Carlin lost control of his motorcycle somewhere near the top and succumbed to the injuries sustained in that crash. Carlin was probably the most famous motorcycle racer at Pikes Peak. He was the first one to win the race on a battery-powered or zero-emissions motorcycle. He also had a starring role in the movie On Any Sunday Part The Next Chapter, which basically showed him racing that zero emissions bike at Pikes Peak and also doing some speed tests at the Bonneville South Flats. Carlin will be missed. With that, we'll move into Moto3 qualifying. So it was a really interesting Moto3 qualifying. The interesting part was that Arenas, Brad Binder, Foggia, Masia, Della Porta, and McPhee were all in Q1. These are names that we associate with being the top end guys and are the guys that are definitely the fast people. So to see them in the Q1 session was a bit of a shock. But what happened was everybody made it out. All was well. And we also had the fact that Chad Onchu was looking much better. And this weekend, we're getting back to the tracks that he's used to racing on from the European Cup Challenge that he was racing. He seemed to be sort of that kind of magical guy that we saw back in Valencia at the end of last year. He had some pace. He really looked good. So hopefully he's turned a corner, found something, and is going to be able to progress and keep it going. As qualifying two wound down, Toba had went in with an amazing paint job on that bike. By the way, the classic silver fairings with the yellow stripe with the red tank and tail section, reminiscent of the very first Hondas from way back. Absolutely brilliant. Totally cool. Love the color scheme. I'm sure Harry Lloyd would have loved it as well. But Toba had everybody covered by a half a second with time winding down, which is, in Moto3 standards, a half a second is just an absolutely incredible amount of time to have on anyone. But he actually got nipped at the very end by Antonelli. Antonelli took it by about a hundredth of a second, which was amazing. Great ride for him to come in there. But the thing that kind of surprised me out of all this was the fact that Aaron Canet did not qualify very well at all out of the second session. He had mistakes here and there. He looked uncomfortable on the bike. He appeared as though he was definitely fighting it. He really did not have anywhere that he could actually run in, and it was just not pretty at all. It was uncomfortable. He wasn't comfortable on the brakes. It looks like he couldn't get anything going. He was sloppy. Just really, really ragged, which is not how Canet has been riding so far this year. So that was a big surprise to me. But qualifying ended up with Antonelli, Toba, Arbolino occupying the front row, Suzuki, Vietti, Agura on the second row, then Kornfeld, who had been very, very fast during the free practice sessions, and then Della Porta in eighth, and then Canet actually did struggle through and made it into ninth. Moving on to the Moto3 race. This race was a classic Assen Moto3 race. Basically, anybody who was in the top 10 was leading at some point during the race. You pick a name out of a hat, they probably were at the front of the pack. And the racing was close, it was tight. It's what we expect out of Moto3. It's what we expect out of these guys. Again, at one point during the race, in the first opening laps, there were 22 motorcycles covered by a second and a half. I mean, think about it. That's an amazing statistic unto itself. And the helicopter shots, of course, of Assen were amazing as well. As you saw that long, snaky train of motorcycles, 22 bikes, all in line, just going through the fast switchbacks and curves that are from the far end of the track back to the last chicane on the circuit. Speaking of the last chicane, Sasaki had an amazing save in the last chicane. He sort of got it wrong as he went through the left-hander, kind of looks like he got on the curb, got a little squirrely. He basically pretty much had tucked the front and was going onto the high side. Somehow managed to catch the bike, got himself squarely centered back up onto the bike. A very Randy Mamola-esque again this weekend. And he wound up with both wheels on the ground, pointed in the correct direction, and was moving forward again. So a great save by Sasaki. Fanati was looking good in this race. Fanati actually had led for a little bit. It was very easy to find Fanati in the pack. He has those very differing lines where he's very much to the outside, or he's running a line that is very counterintuitive to what everybody else is running. So I was looking for good things from Fanati. He was definitely riding well. He was definitely near the front. So I was expecting maybe a podium from Fanati, trying to make it, you know, he's got this comeback. He's trying to do well. It really hasn't clicked for him as of right now, but it looked like maybe things were getting better. Another surprise ride was from Darren Binder. He was qualified in 25th, and he actually had made his way to 4th by going to the front following Della Porta. So from their bad qualifying position, you know, from Della Porta's qualifying position of 8th, Binder wound up hooking up with Della Porta when he got to 8th, and the both of them kind of came through the pack to go to the front and lead. Canet couldn't make anything happen, much like he was in practice and in qualifying. He could not get the bike to work for him. He was running back in the 8th, 9th, 10th spots. A lot of times he was down and far down as 13th. That's sort of been his MO of late. He definitely hangs out at the back of the pack. That tail end of the lead group for most of the race, and then somehow pulls it together at the end and makes his charge. So at this point in the race, I was not particularly worried that he may or may not have it together at this point, But there was always that possibility that things would not be going the way that he wanted, the way that he wanted them to. Of note, McPhee had also made his way to the front. He had had a crash in qualifying, and so he did not qualify very well as a result. But he was on his way to the front too. So that was interesting. Again, you know, here's guys that we've kind of come to see, Kinnett, McPhee, Binder, Delaporta. They're all sort of qualifying farther down the grid than where we think they should be, but somehow managed to race their way to the front every weekend, which is kind of an amazing feat, especially in Moto3, which goes to Derek's point. It doesn't really matter where you qualify in Moto3, so long as you qualify, you pretty much got a shot at being at the front or being near the front. Things were going well for everybody, including Toba, until we had a big crash at Turn 5. Turn 5 seemed to be the place that was going to be the most problems. There was a lot of crashes there this weekend, and Turn 5 definitely got the better of these guys. Toba, Vietti, and Suzuki and Fernandez all took a tumble. It looked as though that Vietti had got in there a little bit hot, lost the front end, and basically he went down a heap and nobody had anywhere else to go, and they all sort of skittered off into the kitty litter. What was great was that everybody who was down was back up, and that's always good to see. Meanwhile, at the front, a new player had emerged. Kornfeld got his elbows out, and he charged up to the front. He was looking to be a historic first-time winner, somebody from the Czech Republic winning a Moto3 event. But he, as soon as he had gotten to the front, with about the 6 laps to go, it came across that the stewards had found out that he was going to be issued the long lap penalty for having shortcut at the circuit. Now, he did shortcut the chicane. They did go back and show us the video of that event. He did shortcut it, so he definitely did deserve the penalty for it. But boy, you had to feel for Kornfeld. He had actually had pulled out a lead, and he was about a half a second ahead, which isn't very much in Moto3 terms, but still, he had a lead and didn't look like he was going to be able to be touched at all. Delaporta was going with him, and everybody was wondering if Delaporta, with Red Mist down, was going to catch Kornfeld and then actually go through the long lap penalty with him, but he didn't. Kornfeld got through that on the turns four and five long lap, and that dropped him back from his first place position to his third place position. Delaporta then inherited the lead, and as it wound down, Arbolino was there with him. I thought this was Delaporta's time. He's been second in numerous times. I thought we were going to get that 13th winner in 13 different MotoGP races, which would be absolutely incredible. However, Delaporta put on a very bold move heading into the last chicane that left Delaporta without the ability to attack. It was a great move, great positioning by Arbolino to then take the win over Delaporta. Kornfeld, suffering a long lap penalty, came in third. Rodrigo was fourth, and then we had John McPhee in fifth. Aguirre was sixth. Ramirez, seventh. Eighth went to Antonelli. Foggia in ninth. Lopez was in tenth. Our good friend Fanati in 11th. He had fallen back down the pack. What was working for him in the beginning wasn't working in the end. And then we had our champion. If we look at this point standings in the championship after this race, Kennett gets a huge break by having Arbolino actually beat Delaporta to take the victory. That allowed Kennett to stay on top of the championship standings with 107. Delaporta, finishing second in the race, stays in second place in the championship on exactly 100 points. So there's only 7 points between Kennett and Delaporta. For Kennett, that was definitely not the best weekend he could have had. He definitely lost points in the championship to Delaporta, but Delaporta was able to make up. It kind of evens itself out, I guess, in my opinion, because Delaporta had a bike failure last week in Barcelona, didn't take any points, and Delaporta getting second this time, and Kennett finishing back kind of gives us a more of a equal playing field. This championship is far from over, but you got to believe that both Kennett and Delaporta are the men to beat, and it's going to probably be this two-man fight for the rest of the year to see who's actually going to win. It's also going to be interesting because it is the battle of manufacturers. It is KTM versus Honda for the championship, so that will be interesting to watch as time goes on. On to Moto2 qualifying. So the Moto2 boys did not disappoint with qualifying. This was actually a very great session. Remy Gardner took his first pole in the intermediate class, his first career pole in MotoGP. It was a brilliant lap by Gardner at a 136.5. This is the first time an Aussie's been on pole in the middleweight class since, wait for it, yeah, that's right, Casey Stoner, 2015, Phillip Island. Bonus points are added to everybody who got that one right. But more importantly, not only was Gardner's pole amazing for him, and definitely the confidence boost that he needs to maybe springboard and start his season, but the man who qualified second, Brad Binder, the KTM. Apparently this chassis that was talked about early on, this rebuild or new design or highly modified chassis, however you want to look at it, apparently is a massive step forward in the right direction for KTM. Binder was on the pole for a long time until Gardner set that lap at the very end. So definitely KTM has it together right now. They're going in the right direction, and hopefully we'll be able to see a little bit more action where they're able to take on Kalex at these next rounds. And pretty much I think everybody who's on a non-factory KTM ride in Moto2 is probably yelling, please, can I have one? Please, can I have one? Because, again, it's a monumental jump forward that KTM actually moved to. We're talking about guys that were definitely down qualifying in that 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th position and racing around, barely getting into the points. And now you've made a massive jump to the front of the grid. Although, be it, it is only qualifying, but maybe KTM had actually found the magic that they had lacked from last year. So, rounding out qualifying, we had Gardner on pole. Binder was second. Verhe, last week I was asking, where did Xavi Verhe go? Well, apparently Xavi Verhe has figured out something with his Kalex bike. He maybe is copying maybe some of Marquez's settings. Maybe he's just finally found his groove. Don't really know right there. But to qualify third and on the front row was a great sign that Verhe is back to the old Verhe and is the Verhe that we've known from the past season. Marquez started on fourth. He's in the first two rows. Don't really think that's bad for him. He's definitely right there. He was only 0.2 down from pole. So that was a good position for him. Lowe's was fifth. Gigi and DG Antonio was sixth. Seventh went to Navarro on the speed up, actually having being the second best speed up because DG Antonio, his teammate, qualified ahead of him. Luthi, not having the best of qualifying sessions, was eighth. Bastianini then ninth, and Locatelli rounding out the top 10. When the lights turned green for Moto2, Binder got the whole shot. And the question would be, could Binder actually lead a lap? He did. So KTM has now led a lap, finally this year, in Moto2. Binder looked really good on the KTM. It looked solid in the beginning of the race, but the question was, well, how were things going to be when they got to the end? But we would have to wait and see because we were still in the very early portions of the race. Gardner was on the move. He didn't get the best hole shot. He was in the lead pack. But what was interesting was the amount of mistakes that he was taking. He ran wide at turn one. He had another slight off other places on the track. Gardner looked like he was feeling maybe the pressure of having one pole and was trying to live up to maybe the expectation that he was going to win the race. From his post-qualifying interview with Simon Crafar, he did say that, you know, hey, I've had pace. I had everybody pretty much covered. I should have been on pole. I was on pole, and I've got pace. So I think maybe he was looking ahead, or maybe he was just riding tight because he had that pole, and maybe the expectation was a little bit too much for him, because it happens to people. You can realize that you have the machine to win, and you know that you just got to go out there and do your thing, and sometimes that's the hardest thing to do. Mentally, it's a big hurdle to try to get over, trying to understand that you are that good, and you want to prove to people that it wasn't a one-lap wonder, that you weren't doing anything special just to take that bike and put it on pole. You want to show people that you deserve to be on at front and deserve a win. However, it wasn't going to work out for Gardner. He eventually crashed at the chicane on a low side. For the longest portion of the beginning of the Moto3 race, it really looked like sorry, at the very beginning of the Moto 2 race, it actually looked like a Moto 3 race. People were changing positions, going forward and backwards, and it was really good racing. Moto 2 has kind of been the bit of the snoozer race, and not this time. Everything looked good. Binder was still out front with the KTM, and any time that like Fernandez would go past him, Binder was able to out-accelerate back out of the turn 5 corner, and that's always been a strength of the KTM chassis. They've always been able to really get the power down and be able to accelerate well out of corners, and Binder was just riding so well. So was Fernandez, but it was so good to actually see that KTM up front, and lo and behold, from his lowly starting position, Jorge Martin, our Moto 3 world champion from last year, caught the lead pack. He was going for it, and he was taking no prisoners on his way to the front. Martin actually bumped Lowe's and knocked Lowe's down. Did he really mean to do it? No, it was just good, close, tight racing. Lowe's was definitely not happy about it. He tumbled in the gravel trap. He got up and let Martin know that he was number one in his eyes. So there was a bit of sign language there that I think had a rearview mirror been attached to Martin's bike, he would have not been impressed by. But Lowe's, with Lowe's down, Martin still was moving towards the front, and he was definitely going for it. Again, he had a no-holds-apart to it. Now, Marquez was laying back. He was riding still in that 4-5 position, which has kind of been his way that he's actually ran races. Been at the back, kind of saved the tires, wasn't letting anybody get too far away. But he was riding, again, the Marquez race. So as it was going on through, Marquez had worked his way up to second, but Binder had pulled out a 1.2 second lead. Now, that was a bit of an amazement. We were late in the race, and Binder was still out front, and no one could really do anything with him. Fernandez had tried, couldn't shake him. If he got by, Binder went right back by again, so Marquez decided it was time to go. Marquez was trying to hunt down Binder, and then Martin crashed. So as Marquez went to second and was trying to chase down Binder, Martin crashed. If you watch the video of the crash, the front end is just chattering so bad. The pump on the front end is just up and down, up and down, up and down. I'm surprised the tire really never did leave the asphalt, but basically what happens in chatter is as the front end is compressing and it's sort of pogoing like a pogo stick, the tire is deforming and then coming back up and then deforms again and comes back up and deforms and comes back up. So the grip level on the front changes because the contact patch on the front tire is changing, not to mention that the whole thing's sort of shaking through the handlebars and whatnot. So with that, Martin goes down. He's now out of the race. With 5 laps to go, all hell breaks loose in this race. There's a huge crash. Vierge gets in to turn 5. He kind of loses it. He doesn't get the drive out of the corner he's expecting. Fernandez has nowhere to go. They basically touch. Vierge falls down. Fernandez is now runs off the track to avoid the falling Vierge. Luthi somehow amazingly rides through the carnage and just misses Vierge, his body, and the bike. So Luthi threads the needle straight between the two objects, doesn't hit anything, and keeps on going. Marquez, who was out front, doesn't know that this crash is taking place. He looks to pull the pin, and he's going to be gone. The big benefactor of the crash is actually Baldessari, who's been kind of lingering at the front of the pack but hasn't really done anything, but he's now free to kind of go chase down Marquez. If Marquez was at the back of the pack, he was there with Baldessari, so the two of them could have potentially been saving their tires for the final run. So Baldessari takes off, tries to run down Marquez, but when we get down to it, at the very end, with 2 laps to go, Baldessari goes up the inside of Marquez. He loses the front and takes out Marquez. Both of them go into the gravel trap. It's a racing incident. The door was there. It was slightly open. It's that double apex turns 3 and 4, that double apex there. Marquez was running a little wide, probably trying to preserve some of the tires, or that was just his line. It looked like there was an opening there. Baldessari was definitely in the opening. He didn't do anything wrong. He just loses the front. He tried a little too hard. Tires, it was so hot. It was like there was well over 100 and some odd degrees Fahrenheit of track temperature. The Dunlaps were probably getting close to being at the end of their life. They were being pushed on, and he just simply lost the front. It's a shame that Marquez is taken out in the crash, but that's racing. What happens next is probably inexcusable. Marquez basically gets up out of the gravel trap and loses his shit. That's no exaggeration. He literally wants to take Baldassare's head off. And the two of them, he just runs over, just starts shaking his fist at him. He gets in Baldassare's face. I get it. I've been mad before when I've been put down or knocked off racing. And there's a time and a place for everything. And that was not the time and the place. You know, if Marquez would have tumbled through the gravel trap, kind of looked over at Baldassare and gave it a, hey, what did you do? Two hands up kind of a thing. I could have been okay with it. But running over to him, especially when Baldassare was actually still had one leg under his motorcycle and wasn't really in any position to actually try to get up and either defend himself or be able to actually talk to Marquez, it was definitely a red mist incident. I hope that Marquez is not fined for that incident. I mean, for great TV. I mean, let's face it, the Daytona 500 here in the United States wouldn't be as thrilling as it was if it wasn't for the very first race with a punch out between Carl Yarborough and Buddy Baker, I think. Anyway, there's nothing like a little emotion sometimes because these guys are usually very well prepped and prepared because they're being courted by their sponsors and whatnot. So sometimes it's nice to see some raw emotion, but there is a point when too much raw emotion is too much. And I think this time Marquez did step over the line. So with that crash done and two laps to go, Fernandez is out front. He's ahead of Bender. Fernandez will go on for the win. Bender will ride to second. Luca Marini lucks into a third place position. Luthi, who avoided the big crash with five laps to go with Vierge, comes in fourth. And then Nakashima, Locatelli, Manzi, Schroeder, Agatar, and Bezzecchi finish out the top 10. This shakes up the point standings in Moto2 considerably. Marquez, who was leading going into the event, now finds himself trailing again, having scored no points while Luthi came home in fourth. Luthi now stands on 117 points, with Marquez on 111 points. That's a six-point difference, which is absolutely positively nothing. What we're now seeing is the fact that this race is really going to go down to the wire. There is going to be some great racing, and I think it's going to be between Luthi, Marquez, and Fernandez to the championship. Fernandez is running in third at 92 points. Havaro on the speed up is on 89. He's starting to lose touch with everybody else. Baldassare may be in with a shout at 88. He did look good until he had that crash with Marquez. Then Marini in 6th, Schroeder, Bender, Bastianini, and Gardner in 10th. Of note, when Fernandez won the race, he pulled over with the Triumph, and the bike did not keep running. It had stalled. He had a whale of a time trying to restart the Triumph. We saw that in qualifying as well. It seems as though that when the Triumphs go off the track, somebody crashes low sides, they are an incredibly difficult motor to actually get started again. In fact, they couldn't even get Fernandez's bike to start again. He actually had to grab a scooter and ride back to Parc Fermé for the championship celebrations. When was the last time you can remember the winning bike not actually being in Parc Fermé? Bonus points to whoever can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com and let me know who actually was the last person to win a race without his motorcycle in Parc Fermé. So I don't know what exactly it is with the Triumph motor. I don't know if it's the firing order, if it's the way the clutch is in that bike, or if it's something just as simple that those motors don't like to be heat soaked, where all the heat tends to evaporate the fuel and the fuel injectors or the cylinder, it's not really the float bowl, but any of the fuel lines that are running down to the injectors. Perhaps maybe they need some kind of a clearing mechanism on it where they flush out all the hot fuel for very cold fuel coming from the gas tank. Endurance cars like Porsche GTs, the Corvettes, the Ferraris, they have a system by when they go to restart for a pit stop after the Le Mans 24 that the fuel rails get purged with of the warm fuel and it falls back on the return line to the tank and fresh cold fuel is then thrown into the cylinders. So maybe Triumph needs to look into that. But that ends up our Moto2 race. So, moving on to MotoGP. In the first qualifying session, we find Alex Rins. No surprise there. He doesn't seem to do very well at qualifying. Then we also had Valentino Rossi. But that was it. None of the other Yamahas are in Q1. They've all made it to Q2. As Q1 came to an end, Rins came in and was almost a half a second clear of Paul Espargaró on the KTM. Rossi would finish fourth in that session, unable to get any better and go through to Q2. The beginnings of what is basically a terrible weekend for Rossi. It was great to see Espargaró go through on the KTM. Poor Zarco, though, was eighth in the first qualifying session. And if you were to watch Zarco's bike through the final chicane, you could see that his bike was terribly slow in transition from left to right. It's as if it's a three-part move for him. First, get the bike to get up to center, ride straight for a second, and then heave the bike over to the opposite side. There's no flow. Contrasting that to how Rins goes through there with the Suzuki was absolutely night and day different. The bike is a V4, that is the KTM. So it's like the Suzuki, it's like the Honda, but even the Honda transitions faster between there than the KTM. Could it be that the KTM has a much longer wheelbase, or is it just a setting that they can't find, or does it have something to do with the carbon swing arm? Because I believe Zarco does not run the carbon swing arm that Espargaró seems to like and favor, so could be that there's like a weight issue, sort of a dynamic, an unsprung weight thing that keeps Zarco from being able to ride over the top. But again, KTM is struggling except for Espargaró. Apparently they're like a lot like Honda. They built a bike that only Espargaró can ride, where Honda has built a bike that only Marquez can ride. So hopefully with Danny Pedrosa now testing for KTM, they'll get some more improvements on the bike, and hopefully we'll see Zarco sort of start to move his way up to the front. The second qualifying session was dominated by Fabio Quartararo. Quartararo winds up on pole with a new track record at a 132.0. He looked fantastic, and he was super brave. That Yamaha had the wiggles, and Aston is a little bit bumpy, and fast directions of change do tend to be all about where a rider sits as far as getting transfer correct, to where maybe Quartararo's positioning on the bike was giving us a bit of that head shake, but he was brave and just simply held it on. To make things even better for Yamaha, Maverick Viñales was second quick, only a tenth behind Quartararo. Rins, who now suddenly seems to have magically figured out how to actually qualify on the Suzuki, has gone through Q1 and has wound up on the front row in third place. Which brings us to Marc Marquez. For the first time this year, Marc Marquez is not starting on the front row of a race. And even after the race, Marquez said that it was Yamaha's race to lose and he was going to have to ride for the points. Juan Mir was fifth, showing that the Suzukis have great potential, because that's the highest we've seen Mir qualify. And hopefully this is a thing to come for Mir, that maybe he's kind of got the MotoGP bike figured out now. A little bit of seat time does wonders, and now maybe this will boost his confidence even more to where Mir will actually be up in the top six at every qualifying, which would be great to see. It would be great for the Hamamatsu team. Crutchlow was sixth in qualifying, proving that really only Marquez can ride a Honda still. Then we had Petrucci, who was seventh, Nakagami eighth. Morbidelli, the other Yamaha, was in ninth. Still, Yamaha having a very good weekend. Quartararo, Viñales, and Morbidelli all in the Q2 session off the bat and all on merit. They were talking about the differences between Quartararo's bike and Viñales' bike, and basically there is none. It is pretty much a 2019 factory Yamaha that Quartararo is on. There may be some small software issue or software variances that maybe Quartararo doesn't have, but essentially that bike is a factory motorcycle. Where was Dovizioso, you ask? Well, he was in 11th behind Jack Miller, who was 10th, and Espargaró 12th. Dovizioso not looking comfortable on the Ducati at all. Being outqualified by four places by his teammate Petrucci is not what Dovizioso needed for the start of this race, especially for his championship challenge, which is looking slimmer and slimmer only 8 races in. Basically, it appeared as though that the problem with the Ducati is the same one. It simply cannot turn. Petrucci said a lot about that in a great article by Matt Oxley on Motorsports Magazine, that the Ducati is very much a squirt and point kind of motorcycle. They have to either square off or kind of diamond the corner. These long on the edge of the tire corners are not good for it, and they simply can't deal with it. They either use up the tire and have no edge grip, or they can't make a fast lap. With all that said and done, we get into the MotoGP race, which happened to be probably the least favorite race of mine for the weekend. Rins did get out front. He was looking pretty solid out there. And then within 2 laps, Rins outbrakes himself, locks the front, tucks it, and goes down. What would have probably been an assured victory for Rins was taken from him by his own mistake. I don't think anybody could have ran with Rins because he was definitely quick. The Suzuki is a sweet handling motorcycle, and that's the kind of motorcycle that you need to run at Assen. We also know that Assen has now gotten fairly bumpy on some of the exits of the corners and also on the entry. There's more bumps than there has been normally at Assen. And where else does the Suzuki run well where there's bumps? Coda. So basically, I think Rins was on track for a victory and what would have probably been a runaway victory if he hadn't outbraked his own self. Much like we talk about Marc Marquez being the only person who can beat Marc Marquez. Well, I think this time Alex Rins was the only person who could beat Alex Rins, and Alex Rins beat himself. But that left us with Quartararo and Vinales out front in the race. They pretty much were going at it with each other. The surprise, well, what was really no surprise given his qualifying, was the fact that Juan Mir was up front. Mir was running with the front pack. He was looking good. Maybe he was going to be the Suzuki that was going to win. You never know. But again, the only person who could beat Juan Mir was Juan Mir, and he wound up running wide, which put him back to fourth. The next thing we know, with Quartararo leading, and when Vinales and Marquez going after each other, so every time Vinales would pass Marquez, Marquez would stuff it back up the back, would stuff it back up the inside of the next corner. We saw something out of the corner of our eye, and that was Valentino Rossi crashing again. He actually crashed with Nakagama. The interesting fact was that right after that crash, Rossi got himself up, went over to see how Nakagama was, told him that, you know, basically, you know, maybe it was his fault. The camera angle was inconclusive, but Rossi was on the inside, and I have a feeling that those two touched, and, you know, Rossi was at least over there looking after a fellow competitor, which I think is always great to see in contrast to the Alex Marquez show that we had in Moto2. With 20 laps to go in the race, Marquez had put a pass on Quartararo, who had just was just having massive head shakes out of turn 5 down the short back straight. And the interesting thing was to watch the difference between Quartararo's bike and Vinales' bike. Vinales would go through the same corner on the same bike with the same tire combinations and basically had no head shake whatsoever. But Quartararo would do the same thing, and the bike would just be massively shaking. In fact, it was so bad that from the onboard camera, you could hear that Quartararo would have to back off the gas. And of course, if you back off the gas on straightaway, you're going to get passed, which is exactly what would happen. Marquez would go blowing by him. But then Quartararo would just simply ride back underneath Marquez again. Quartararo really had a great chance to actually win this race. And I would have been totally 100% behind that. Thought it would have been great if he could do it. But Vinales gets by Marquez at this chicane and is basically trying to head off Quartararo. Vinales had now basically gotten Quartararo and was out front. Was this going to be bye-bye? Because Vinales had made several mistakes. He had ran wide and had fallen back to third. Had caught back up to Marquez, passed him, then caught back up to Quartararo, only to like run wide again. Fell back behind Marquez, but rode right back up again. Vinales was showing that the Yamaha does have pace. And at least at this track, he had pace. So twice he was able to catch the leading guys and go back to the front. So now that he got it out front, he got going. Again, showing none of that head shake that Quartararo had. Asked about that by Matt Oxley, Quartararo said that it was just his stupidity. He wasn't using the right line, and he was coming off where there were more bumps, where Vinales was riding a wider line, where there weren't as many bumps. And if you put that together with Quartararo's riding position, it would give him the head shakes. Because once Vinales had went by, Quartararo saw where Vinales was coming out of the corner and started to use his line. And when he was using Vinales' line out of that same corner where he always got the head shakes, he didn't have the head shake. So, you know, rookie mistake by Quartararo, but he's definitely going to put that one in the old notebook. And I doubt that Quartararo will ever have that problem again. He'll search out the smoother, faster line, if at all possible. At this point, basically, the race is pretty much down to Marquez and Vinales. Quartararo has started to slide back behind Marquez, and it's a question of whether he can hold on for third. Perhaps maybe Quartararo was having a bit of arm pump. He always said that this race would be extremely difficult for him, but he was definitely falling back. Marquez kept Vinales honest and put a lot of effort into it, but he could not run with the pace of Vinales. So Vinales goes on to win the race. Yamaha's first win since Vinales last year at Phillip Island. He comes home the winner. Marc Marquez comes home second. And then you had Quartararo on the podium again in third. Dovizioso actually had a really pretty good race for him. As far as damage limitation goes, Dovizioso is probably the master of that. He used the advantage of the Ducati's hole shot device to get himself out of that terrible qualifying position and get near the front of the lead pack. He basically ran around there the whole time with his teammate Petrucci and Crutchlow and Juan Mir and Miller. But when push came to shove at the end, Dovizioso caught a little break, got out ahead, but he was being ran down by Franco Morbidelli. Franco had another very good ride on it. He needs to get it going a little bit quicker and needs to not leave it as late as he has. If he could somehow find his pace a little bit earlier in the race, he definitely could have been on the podium or definitely could have beat Dovizioso, because Morbidelli was chasing down Dovizioso on the last lap, and Dovizioso just barely got to the finish line before Morbidelli. The old saying, if there was one more lap, I would have had you, that definitely would have applied to Morbidelli on Dovizioso. So again, I think another rookie learning moment that Morbidelli can put in the notebook and realize that he's got to put the push on a little bit sooner. Petrucci then come home in sixth, Kyle Crutchlow in seventh. Definitely not liking the 2019 Honda. He much prefers the 2018 Honda. Then we had Miller in ninth, and 10th was Iannone, his best finish on the Aprilia. With that, we'll take a quick look at the championship standings. Marc Marquez, no surprise, is still on top of the championship. He pads his points lead. He now has a lead of 140 to 103. So he's now got a 37-point lead in the championships. He's bordering on getting close to that magical 50 mark, where that would be two race wins. Alex Rins did his championship no good whatsoever with having a DNF and not finishing. He's on 101 points. He's only two behind Dovizioso, but he fell from second to third. Petrucci is fourth. Rossi's fifth, despite his crash. Miller, Quartararo in seventh, now banking podiums. Look for Quartararo to move up the standings in the championship. Nakagami's eighth. Paul Espargaro ninth. And Kyle Crutchlow is there in 10th. So that's how the action came down from the Assen TT. We now move on in a week's time. This coming weekend, we'll be at the Sachsenring. That is the Marc Marquez happy hunting ground. It will be very interesting to see if Marquez can win his 10th race in a row there. It's a track that suits Marquez. It's a predominantly left-handed circuit, which is all about what Marc Marquez is with his dirt track kind of style. Although, I have to admit, I wonder what Rins is going to do on the Suzuki. That's an incredibly well-handling bike. It doesn't use the tires very much, and it pretty much is the best handling machine on the grid. What about Yamaha for next week? We've seen Yamaha, have they got it now? Can Quartararo get another pole? What's going to happen there? Again, it's another great story because maybe the Yamahas have found something, and I hope that they have, because there's nothing better than seeing a Yamaha battling a Honda, battling a Ducati to try to figure out who's going to be on the podium. And it's also good to see the independent bike, or satellite bike, up there as well. But all those questions will be answered in a fortnight's time when we get back together again, and we'll talk about all the racing from Saxon Ring. Hope you enjoyed the solo show, everyone. Talk to you after the Saxon Ring.